Case number 12-1060 et al. New England Power Generators Association, Inc. Petitioner versus Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. Mr. Tykwer for petitioners NSTAR Public Systems. Mr. Schwartz for petitioners MMWEC. Mr. Lampkin for petitioners NEPGA. Mr. Shepard for interveners PSEG Energy Resources and Trade et al. Mr. Kennedy and Ms. Pasella for respondent FERC. And Ms. Frank for intervener CT Pura.
All right. While counsel gets settled, the court will take a short break.
This audible court is again in session. Be seated, please.
May it please the court, my name is Steve Tykwer. I'm here on behalf of NSTAR today. The commission repeatedly acknowledges that it resolves most of its contested cases through settlements. It also has acknowledged that the fastest way to discourage settlements is to grant reopening at the behest of a single disgruntled party. Yet that is exactly what has happened here. Commission's longstanding policy has been that it will not disturb a settlement absent special circumstances. Here we had 170 people participate in 30 formal scheduled settlement conferences over a period of 4 months. And both sides made painful concessions to preserve what they believed was essential to their business model or their objectives. There has been no change in circumstances since the settlement was adopted. It is the market is acting exactly as economic theory would predict. Since in the years subject to this case, installed capacity has consistently exceeded the capacity requirement, and hence the market has cleared at low rates. This is the normal functioning of supply and demand. The market power mitigation measures at issue were before the Commission when it approved the settlement. Both ISC New England and the market monitors had an opportunity to comment on that scheme when it was submitted for filing. And indeed, it was before this court in its main case. Moreover, there's been no suggestion that market power has played a single role, any role at all, in the clearing of the auctions, not by a penny. In every auction, the market monitor has certified that the resultant price is just and reasonable, and the commission has affirmed that determination. The commission in this case, has conflated sections 206 and 205 to arrive at a foreordained result. Under 205, the commission's options are essentially limited to approving, accepting the 205 filing, or rejecting it. What it may not do is use the pretext of a 205 filing to fashion a remedy of its own liking to affect the underlying tariff. And that's exactly what has happened here.
You're not arguing, are you, that the commission could never modify a settlement, or are you?
I am.
You are?
That
I am arguing that special circumstances have to be exempt for the commission to modify a settlement. And here, the commission has not shown any special circumstances, and hasn't even tried to.
What in your view would be a special circumstance that would justify the commission in seeking to modify?
If something wasn't working.
The argument here is that there was an alternative price rule, and that was a failure.
Well, our point is it wasn't a failure. Two, it worked precisely as drafted in the face of excess supply versus demand. There was no occasion whatsoever for that rule to be triggered under any circumstance. Second, we contend there's no out-of-market resources in the market in the first place. The record is unblemished in its revelation that there's only two principal sources of supply that showed up after the settlement was reached. One was imported capacity, and the second was demand resources. The commission in the very orders on the record here says they can't figure out what the cost of imports is. So you can't be making sales below cost. So that's off the table. And with the demand resources, they subsequently determined that the value of demand resources is a dollar, and there has been no allegation in this record whatsoever that demand resources have been coming up on the market below the cost of $1. And the commission didn't simply tweak the settlement here. The commission rewrote it from the ground up. We were supposed to have a free market for capacity. The commission imposed essentially a horizontal supply curve. We were supposed to have the option to self-supply. It was a cherished right throughout the negotiations, and yet the commission has obviated that. So we contend that the commission has acted contrary to its own precedent, and without substantial record support, and therefore should be reversed. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Jeffrey Schwarz. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. Your Honors, I'm here today on behalf of consumer-owned retail utilities seeking to retain a right that retail utilities have enjoyed for a century. The right to choose which generating facilities will provide electricity-producing capacity for their customers. FERC and the generators talk a lot about uneconomic entry, but let's be clear what they're talking about. They're lumping together two very different things. One is a risky and rare strategy to incur above-market costs in the hope of lowering prices enough to recoup losses. Free rider effects make that strategy unlikely, and the record here contains no FERC finding that anybody has engaged in it. The other type of uneconomic entry is simply the way that retail utilities and their regulators must do business. It is traditional power supply planning that takes into account both cost and non-cost factors when choosing new generation facilities. In New England's forward capacity market, self-supply was the mechanism to accommodate utility planning decisions. Self-supply is when a retail utility decides to build a resource itself outside the auction or buy a resource outside the auction and wants to use it to serve a portion or all of its capacity requirement imposed upon it by the ISO, so long as the resource meets applicable technical criteria to ensure that it can actually provide capacity, then it offsets the same amount of the capacity requirement that the utility otherwise would bear.
As far as the resource that produces the self-supply as opposed to the power itself, to what extent is that a question of jurisdiction with respect to FERC?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Does FERC have jurisdiction over the resource that's doing the self-supply?
No, it does not have jurisdiction over that resource. Your Honors, self-supply is essential in the context of this market because without self-supply, this auction has no mechanism to consider resources' environmental or operational characteristics. It has no means to ensure fuel diversity, no means to hedge market risk, and no means to plan to meet reliability needs more than 3 years in advance. Without self-supply, the auction simply buys the cheapest capacity, regardless of what it is. Respectfully, you can't run an electric system that way any more than you could feed your family exclusively on a diet of oatmeal. Now, FERC says that intentional price manipulation and legitimate self-supply have the same effect on prices, but that doesn't mean it's reasonable to treat them equivalently. Low-cost entry also reduces prices, but nobody suggests that's a problem. Here, what's going on is retail utilities are choosing somewhat higher cost resources that also have higher benefits to meet their customers' needs. And when utilities self-supply those resources, that is, they develop them outside the auction, that reduces the amount of capacity that needs to be bought through the auction, and that reduces prices. But that's simply how a market works. Now, even if FERC were correct that there was a wholesale rate problem that needed to be fixed here, FERC has chosen an impermissible means of doing it. For the first time, FERC has adopted rules that interfere directly with utility resource choices and that force utilities to buy other capacity that they neither need nor want.
I think FERC would say that they're interfering indirectly and that therefore that's okay. So maybe you could explain how this is a direct regulation.
Well, Your Honor, let me answer that question by drawing a contrast between this case and the Connecticut DPUC case that the court decided. In prior cases, in that case, in every prior case, what FERC did was to say that utilities have to procure X amount of resources and utilities had the freedom to decide whether and how they wanted to do that. And if they didn't do it, FERC imposed a deficiency charge. And in Connecticut, this court held that setting the total amount of capacity in the context of a market that had self-supply and flexibility was simply tantamount to telling utilities how much they would have to pay if they didn't provide resources outside the market. And in the course of that opinion and in other cases, the court has said that merely setting a rate that influences utility and state decisions is not a direct interference. Here, the commission is doing the exact opposite. It's reaching upstream and acting as a gatekeeper over individual offers for individual resources and deciding which of those a retail utility may use to satisfy its capacity requirement. That's unprecedented, and FERC may not do it. The consequences of FERC telling us that we can't use our resources are enormous. If FERC precludes us from using our resource, that means that we must buy other auction-selected capacity instead. That compelled purchase by itself violates the Federal Power Act.
Okay, let me interrupt you again. You said if FERC precludes us, and the way I had understood this is that they don't preclude you from doing it. You can still self-supply. It's just not cost-effective to do that.
Well, what the commission now allows is you can self-supply with existing resources.
I see.
And with new resources that are
that
cheap enough to
committed.
Clear.
Okay.
But essentially what FERC is saying is you can self-supply with resources that you don't need to self-supply because they would clear the auction anyway. So if FERC says that a given resource that you would like is too expensive, then you may not use it to satisfy your capacity requirement and you have to buy other auction-selected capacity instead. After that, one of two things will happen. Either we'll forego the resource that we want because FERC won't give us credit for it, or we'll go ahead and build it, pay for it, and pay for the other auction-selected capacity in addition. FERC may neither regulate generation nor compel us to enlarge our generation facilities, and FERC's chosen structure necessarily violates one or the other. If we choose to abandon our resource, then FERC's double payment requirement will have prevented us from developing the resources we want. If we go ahead and build it, but FERC ignores it and requires us to buy other auction-selected capacity instead, then FERC will have forced us to enlarge our generation facilities. If the court has no further questions, I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. Jeff Lampkin on behalf of the generator petitioners. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. The commission's repeatedly ruled, and this court has agreed, that for capacity prices to be just and reasonable, the prices over time must average out to the cost of new entry. So the generators have an opportunity, a fighting chance, to recover their investments and a return. I want to focus today on two ways in which FERC's order departs from that lodestar. First, FERC conceded that buyer-sponsored below-cost entry would suppress auction prices in the foreseeable future, but it refused to make any correction. Second, addressing the theoretical possibility of seller market power, it prevented sellers from changing their bidding behavior in response to falling prices until prices hit a new record low, $1 per kilowatt month, the lowest price seen in any other auction, and in fact, any related auction with typically lower prices. Neither of those decisions is consistent with the Federal Power Act, and neither is consistent with reasoned decision making. Turning to the first, the mitigation of historical out-of-market, historical below-cost entry, FERC conceded that below-cost entry was suppressing auction prices, but it refused to correct that on the theory that its job was merely to deter, and its rules were merely to deter below-cost entry. They weren't to correct it once it occurred. But that defies the Federal Power Act. The Federal Power Act is about just and reasonable rates. It's not about deterrence for its own sake. In fact, the reason the FERC has authority to deter below-cost entry is it produces unjust and unreasonable rates. So when FERC went to only deterrence and ignored the actual rates that were being produced and the depression that was occurring, it substituted a mechanism it had developed for the federal statutory standard it's supposed to follow. FERC suggested that it could use a price floor for a short period of time to mitigate that, but there's no reasonable match between that price floor and the price suppression that occurred. FERC said price suppression can last 7 auctions or more. Price floor lasts 4 auctions. Price floor is based on an administrative estimate of CONE, of cost of new entry, just an estimate. But FERC refused to address arguments and evidence that that estimate was grossly suppressed by the lower auction results that had preceded it. Instead, it dismissed that argument as arguments about the adequacy of the cost of new entry estimate as moot. But FERC can't give you a remedy based on an estimate and then dismiss challenges to the adequacy of that estimate as moot. That's just flat legal error. It doesn't make any sense, and it doesn't withstand reasoned decision-making. If I could turn for just one moment to below-cost imports, I think I really would only need like 5 sentences to address it, because the question seems to come down to, are you going to mitigate below-cost imports, or are you not going to do so? Under FERC's 2-part standard, if you build a below-cost facility within the region, that will be mitigated. But if you build it 200 yards across the line in another region and then use existing transmission facilities to bring the below-cost energy in, that won't be mitigated. That's not just arbitrary. It's incoherent. It means that you can have below-cost entry whenever you want, so long as you just build it outside the region and use existing transmission facilities.
Mr. Lampkin, can you explain below-cost facility?
Yes. What happens is mostly these are buyer-subsidized facilities. These are facilities that are receiving a subsidy, often from the states.
Okay. And so are these state generation facilities, but because they have a – they're public, I'm assuming?
No, usually it's done with a contract. Okay. So, for example, the Connecticut DPUC has a lot of pleadings. I think it's around page 780 of the joint appendix that describes how these are done, and they're usually done with a form of called contracts for differences, which means that what the state does is it guarantees you a long-term contract where if you do not earn a certain amount in the auction, they'll make up the difference. And the impact of that is that the person who has the contract, the generator, is utterly indifferent to the auction price. The price could crater to zero. They're fine because they have a contract for differences that makes the difference to the state.
But why do states want to do that?
Well, that is a really interesting question, and it's a disputed thing. One is that you can actually make money doing it. Because you have a nearly vertical demand curve, when you subsidize even a small amount, and the record here suggests that it's a minimum of 2,000 megawatts, when you subsidize even a small amount, that can have an enormous impact on price and make it a price-winning situation for the person who subsidizes.
Okay. How does the state benefit?
Oh, because the price goes down so much, its consumers get a cheaper rate that exceeds the amount that the state has invested. So, in effect, this is one of the few places where you can actually have what would be the equivalent of a sort of predatory pricing. You actually immediately make up the difference because the price falls much more than the investment you made in below-cost generation. And the Commission specifically found that was going on. There's disputes as to why, whether they're just trying to promote different types of generation, or whether there's actually an effort here to crater the market. But some of the generation units here aren't renewables. They're just gas-fired turbines, as the record suggests. Finally, turning to the question of seller-side mitigation, the Commission interfered with the auction here dramatically. It thought there was a theoretical possibility of market power on the seller side. So it said that sellers cannot lower their bids dynamically, withdraw their bids dynamically in the market in response to falling prices until the price hits $1 per kilowatt month. That's the lowest price that had been seen in a related auction that typically has lower prices than these auctions. And the Commission never adequately justified why the lowest price ever seen would be the starting point at which a generator could start responding to falling prices. It's a little bit like saying you're going to go to an auction at Sotheby's, but you got to keep your paddle up until the price hits a record. It just doesn't make any sense. Under National Fuel, if FERC chooses to rely solely on a theoretical threat, which is the case here, It needs to explain how the potential danger justifies the costly prophylactic rule. That's entirely missing here. There's no reason justification explaining why a dollar is the appropriate threshold as opposed to $1.50 or $2, or why we wouldn't just impose this in constrained zones where you might have more risk of market power as opposed to larger zones which have effective competition. And FERC didn't meaningfully address, most important of all, the impact that this all has on the ability of generators to actually recover their costs and their ability to get what is supposed to be the lodestar, the cost of new entry. The evidence in the record from Professor Stoddard and Bidwell is that if you preclude people from responding to prices dynamically as they're falling until they fall to a record low of a dollar per kilowatt month, they mathematically will rarely have the ability to actually achieve the cost of new entry. And that makes sense. On occasion, when you have new entrants, you'll get cost of new entry. But most other times, when you don't, you're going to drop all the way down to this near what FERC describes as a near zero price. How can you, on average, then, go back to cost of new entry? On average, you're always going to fall short. And although FERC actually acknowledges Professor Bidwell's analysis, it never responds to it. This is just a fundamental and unacknowledged change in the way the market was supposed to work. The market was supposed to be a market where you have bids. But now it's a system of sealed bids, where because you can't really bid in the market until it hits a record price, it's a system of sealed bids, all of which are shuffled to an omniscient market monitor who reviews them all with the lawyers and the accountants, and then...
Can you describe what that entity is, the IMM, monitor? What is this entity?
the market monitor.
They refer to this person or thing or entity. They never did tell us. Lexham and the other thing in these briefs, they never did tell us what they're talking about.
Okay. The market monitor is supposed to serve a function of ensuring that there isn't exercise of market power.
But what is it, he or they?
You know, that's something I wish I knew the answer to. I'm going to have. I think Mr. Shepard will tell you all about it because he'll be able to better describe it for you, and I apologize for that. I see that I'm actually going to go into my rebuttal. So if there are no further questions, I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
You got 30 minutes to tell me what the market
monitor is. I'll tell you very quickly. May it please the Court. Your Honor, John Shepard for Public Service Electric and Gas Corp. The market monitor, and there is one for each one of the RTOs, is a corporate entity, usually headed by one particular person, that is responsible for making judgments about costs and other information upon which offers are based, and not just in the capacity market, but also in the energy market. They are engaged separately, so they're sort of like a subcontractor. Sometimes there's some duplication in the companies that they use. PJM, for example, uses marketing analytics. Generally, people just say Dr. Bowring because for all express purposes, marketing analytics is Dr. Bowring. In many cases, people refer to Potomac Economics, but then they're really just talking about Dr. Patton. So it boils down to the judgment of pretty much one individual, very smart person. I didn't expect that we were going to be talking at all today about relitigating CTD PUC, but I want to bring – I was surprised, Your Honor, when you didn't have a reaction to opposing counsel's assertion that, oh, yes, the FERC has no jurisdiction over these facilities. Okay, they don't have any jurisdiction over the facilities. This isn't a case about facilities. This is a case about price. And FERC absolutely has jurisdiction over the price at which that capacity is sold. This form of behavior, Judge Brown, you asked a lot of questions about why a state would do this. We've been litigating these issues in stereo, in PJM, and in ICE New England. The Third Circuit has a case where this very question is pending before it. And New Jersey and Maryland have adopted the pioneering work of Connecticut in examining the rules and figuring out just how much they can subsidize a new entrant in order to cause a global crash that makes it worth the effort. So in New Jersey, for example, they have legislative testimony saying, so what we're going to do is subsidize $250 million here through contract for differences. That's going to cause a $1 billion crash, which gives us a $750 million gain. This is exactly what's going on here. And you can do that because you can – very easily assess where you are in terms of your installed capacity requirement. Once you know that, it's not like a generation resource or transmission is not going to magically reappear. So you know immediately, but you know with a great deal of certainty how much influence you need to put in order to crash the price. Of course, this isn't really matter as much anymore because now we've got dynamic delist bidding pushed down to $1. That's actually what I meant to spend most of my time talking about. Because Mr. Lampkin covered a lot of that terrain, I'm going to limit that, given my remaining time, to a Burlington Truck Lines problem. If you look at page 307 of your joint appendix, it's the last paragraph in FERC's fourth order where they talk about the justification for the need for moving down to a dollar. And the answer is that, oh, we're moving to eight zones. This is going to give us much more restrictive zones. Therefore, we're going to have a greater chance for market power. Problem. After the briefing concluded in this case in May, and the site for the order is 143 FERC 61198, specifically paragraphs 29 through 31, FERC acceded to ISO New England's request to unify five of the eight zones into only one zone, meaning that there are only now four. And the reason they did it was because ISO New England put in a great deal of evidence saying that we have so many new transmission lines built and so much generation in the market, there's no reason for these zones to separate. So Burlington Truck Lines, 371 U.S. 156 at 172, tells you that when the fundamental premise upon which the adoption of a rule was made evaporates, then what the court needs to do is remand and explain. Yes, it is the case that there are still four zones. That still fundamentally changes the facts because FERC doesn't explain, for example, why a $1 threshold would only be necessary anywhere other than in those four constrained zones, namely Boston and Maine. Or my time is well over now.
I have a question.
Yes, ma'am.
You started out talking about how some folks can gain by crashing the market and taking advantage of the drop in price.
It depends on what your net position is, Your Honor.
Right. So, but
it wouldn't do an independent supplier any good, for example.
Okay. If the idea is to maintain reliability and a level of capacity, how does crashing the market help to preserve that? Or does it not matter?
Well, they're going to get their resource, so that eliminates their reliability worry in the short term. It eliminates their reliability worry because they've gotten their resource. They're going to crash the other people, but they're going to know when those people crash because they're going to bleed out of the market, and FERC's orders must tell us 20 times, its brief must tell us an equivalent number of times. There's been an oversupply in New England since the inception of this market, and now the question is only who dies first as everyone gets bled, and they would prefer that the people who are newly subsidized get to survive and people who've been in the market longer don't. But that's separate from your question. The reason why this is a poor strategy is because it puts us, for two reasons, back in the bad old days, as now the Chief Justice talked about in MISO Transmission Owners. You are going to put us back in the world where there's rate-based support for anything that is built. There's no way for independent generators to compete if they're going to be fighting against rate-based supported entities, which is exactly what Connecticut has decided that they're going to do here. And that is going to unharness you from all the benefits of competition that were supposed to have been achieved from Order 888 and since. Now, there are reasons why this dynamic works this way. There is a built-in death spiral in CONE that has caused the price of CONE to go down every year since the auction first began. There are other governance problems with ISO New England. The generators never have enough votes to cause a 205 or 206 to be filed. There are supermajority requirements for how that's done, so it'll never have a sufficient number of votes. I hope that addresses your question, and
yes.
I am well over time.
Thank you very much.
So I will sit down. Thank you.
May it please the Court, I'm Robert Kennedy on behalf of the Commission. I will be responding to the arguments raised by the NSTAR and public systems petitioners regarding the minimum offer rule. My colleague, Beth Acella, will be responding to the arguments raised by the New England Power Generators and their intervener. And we also have with us today Kimberly Frank on behalf of the Connecticut Department of Public Utilities, who will be addressing the issue of historical out-of-market capacity. Beginning with the jurisdictional question, whether the Commission can implement the minimum offer rule, I think it's important to note there's no dispute in this case that the Commission has the statutory authority and obligation to ensure that the prices for capacity sold at wholesale are just and reasonable. And the minimum offer rule directly relates to the statutory mandate by setting certain minimum prices that parties, new resources coming in to a FERC jurisdictional market, must meet with their offers for supply. And it does this in order to remedy the price suppressive effects of that below-cost new entrants have upon capacity prices. And this affects not only the party sponsoring a resource, the way the market's set up, a single capacity clearing price is paid to all parties in the market. So lowering the price affects everyone, and the Commission has an obligation to find a just and reasonable result for the entire market. Second, as was just being discussed, the market was set up basically to generate price signals, to move away from the time period where all generation was supported by state entities and to harness the efficiencies in the market. And it did this by using efficient competition to send price signals to private investment when the price for capacity is high, signals that there's a need for more generation, and they enter the market. When the price signals are low, signals there's no need for new entry and stay up. But what we've had here, when it's depressed, those price signals don't go out. And ultimately, in the long run, you're going to have existing resources that are otherwise competitive. They're going to exit before they otherwise would have. And you're going to have parties, private entities who want to join the market, they're going to stay away because they can't be assured that they can compete on a level footing when you have subsidized capacity coming in, or certain types of resources have a wholesale exemption, which is what the self-supply advocates call for. In essence, what the minimum offer rule does, it regulates the supply curve in the market. And that is ultimately, when coupled with the installed capacity requirement, which is the demand curve, although it's essentially vertical, that is the mechanism that produces the capacity clearing price. And as this court found in the first of the long lines of Maine public utility cases, capacity pricing issues fall comfortably within the commission's jurisdiction. Now, as to the argument raised that this is essentially, that this crosses the jurisdictional line because it requires states to build generation, or it's essentially regulation of generation facilities, we would submit that that issue is basically resolved by this court's decision in the Connecticut Department of Public Utilities case. There, the issue was the installed capacity requirement. Does the commission have the authority to regulate it? The court said yes, because it's a key input in the market mechanism that results in capacity clearing prices. There, it was the demand curve. Here, the commission is regulating, through the minimum offer rule, the supply curve, another key input into the market mechanism that results in the capacity clearing price. In Connecticut, the petitioners echoed many of the arguments here made in this case, that it's effectively a mandate because if you set the capacity price, if the capacity requirement at a certain level, and we're not there yet, you're compelling us to build because the choice is that if we don't do it, we'll be subject to extraordinarily high capacity prices. So it's really no choice at all.
I understood counsel to be saying that what's happening here is actually the opposite of what was happening in the Connecticut case.
Well, I think it's opposite in the sense that it's looking at opposite sides of the market construct.
No, I didn't follow his argument, but I thought that what he was saying is that it's different to to set to set prices that that influence a certain result than to go upstream and directly affect it.
Well, that's all the minimum price rule does, is set prices. It says when you're a new entrant and you want to come into a FERC jurisdictional market and make a sale, these are the rules that we have for your sales. Now, certainly, there's the possibility that it imposes benchmarks on particular resources. If you come in and want to bid significantly below the benchmark, the average annualized cost of entry for that type of resource, we're going to look at that. It doesn't mean you can't offer it, but you have to justify to the internal market monitor, are those your actual costs? The minimum offer rule doesn't require them to build anything, and it doesn't even forbid them from offering any type of resource they want into the market. It may have the consequence of not letting those resources clear because the market forces may work in such a way that the actual benchmark bid attributed to them may be higher than the ultimate capacity clearing price. But that's not direct regulation. As the court found in responding to similar arguments in the Connecticut case, that's just the requiring them to internalize the true costs of alternatives, and that's a requirement for efficient market outcome, and that's something that the commission can pursue. Now, with respect to sort of why we're doing this, and this gets back to your question, Judge Brown, that you were just discussing. As was talked about, there's the possibility for strategic bidding, and the commission discusses this in summarizes that possibility in paragraph 158 of the third order. And also the petitioners cite to the various orders issued by the commission where it reviewed the results of the first three auctions. And you'll see as you go through, there's a mounting drumbeat from parties in the market saying, look at all this out-of-market capacity coming in. The mitigation scheme we agreed to has never been triggered. What's going on? Look at this Connecticut case. They're setting up this contract in such a way as requiring them to bid low in the market. There's a problem with this. And the commission said, A, particularly with respect to Connecticut, we agree that does look problematic, but there's been such an excess capacity that didn't have any effect on the price now because it reached the price floor. And also, really, only our job here is just to look at the rules and make sure the auction was conducted in accordance with the rules. So this has been flagged as a mounting problem. And the way the rules were set up, and this sort of goes to the settlement point, the parties didn't create this market in the settlement and just say, that's it, we got it perfect. This was a new market. Obviously, it's going to need tweaks over time, and that's the way they set it up in the settlement. There was transition payments to generators. There was a price floor that was set to expire after three auctions. There were limitations on there was also a requirement that the internal market monitor, there he is again, come in and review the results of the auction and how it's functioning after the second auction, which is roughly 2 years. And that ties to the end of essentially the blackout period. The parties had agreed that for 2 years, no one can bring a 206 complaint to the commission asking for a change in the rules. Essentially, if you look at how all these work together, the parties essentially agreed that we're going to see how it works. The market monitor is going to inform our judgment of whether this is working as we thought it would. And then we'll see how it goes, and we can bring tweaks and changes to the commission, and that's what happened here. There was I'm not sure. That certainly this is a significant change, but from the beginning, I think it's important to note that self-supplied resources were always subject to mitigation. They were always, first of all, they had to be offered in the market and cleared, although they acted as price takers. So clearance, as long as they were technically qualified, was essentially guaranteed, but they were part of the market. They were always characterized as out-of-market capacity for purposes of the mitigation rules, and the commission recognized in the Devon Power cases when it approved the settlement that these resources could artificially depress the price because they're being offered at below their true cost of entry. It could suppress the price, which could have long-term problems for the market, because ultimately you may make money in the short term, and you may, for 3 years, maybe you have your reliability met through strategic bidding and suppressing the capacity price, but over the long run, you're not going to attract new entrants to the market.
What do you say to counsel's argument about the location of the resource, that is to say within or without the zone, moving something a mile or a few feet even one way or the other could affect the regulability?
Well, that's actually an issue Ms. Pacella will speak to. That's from her side of the case. I apologize.
I always love that we get
it's a handy out.
We're getting close to it. I will expect her to fully explain that.
But in terms of whether this is a tweak or a significant revision, again, the commission recognized that self-supplied resources, because they are offered below their true cost, could have a negative effect on the capacity clearing price, and ultimately it could be harmful to the long-term viability of the market itself. And it put in place, it said, we have this alternative price rule. We think that's going to be good enough to deal with it. And experience proved, frankly, that it wasn't, that there were more that more out-of-market capacity maybe than the parties envisioned was coming into the market, and that the way the rule was working, it was never triggered. And the key point is that the market was going to change. No longer, petitioner's counsel said, oh, this out-of-market capacity has never had any effect on the price. Well, that's because there's been a price floor, which was set to expire after the third auction. When that's gone, the prices will continue to fall, and this out-of-market capacity will displace otherwise competitive resources that would have set the capacity clearing price. So not only did the settlement contemplate changes, but that the parties would make changes, take a wait-and-see approach, but also the market was changing. That fact, coupled with complaints under Section 206 from the generators, frankly required the Commission to act. There was no mixing and matching between Section 205 and 206, or confusion. The Commission was presented with a rule change filing. It found that parts of it were unjust and unreasonable. It was faced with complaints from parties saying the original rule and the February 2010 proposed revision are unjust and unreasonable, and it had an obligation to fix a just and reasonable rate, and that's what it did by implementing the minimum offer rule.
But what are we to make of the point that Mr. Shepherd apprised us of, that we're now looking like we're dealing with four zones rather than eight zones?
Well, again, I think that more go.
I'm sorry.
I love these questions.
We just can't wait to hear from you.
Unless there are any further questions with respect to the minimum offer rule and its operation in the market, I will I'll let Ms. Pacella get to your questions.
Well, it seems you already know who I am and why I'm here.
We've been waiting for you.
I'll just start. I'm going to start talking about the historical out-of-market capacity, the first three auctions, and why the Commission determined that it would be inappropriate in the circumstances here to further mitigate it once the offer floor mitigation goes into effect, which hasn't happened yet. Petitioners focus only on the Commission's, one of the Commission's rationales. The other rationale is that it would create an improper price signal. And Mr. Kennedy has already talked to you about how important it is as part of this forward capacity market to be setting out proper price signals. And the Commission said, we have such an odd circumstance here of tremendous excess capacity. Everybody agrees there's too much capacity. And we have a circumstance where this capacity came in under the old rules when it was going to be there. It came in under the old rules legitimately. It didn't do anything wrong. And we understand it might affect prices in the future, but we need to send a price signal because people should stop bringing so much capacity into the market. And if we further mitigate the below cost capacity from the first three auctions, once the new market takes over, the price will be so high, relative, it'll be higher than it should be to signal that there should be less capacity. And petitioners, you know, ignore that rationale, I think, because it's very hard to get over. The Commission also talked about the price floor. It recognized that the price floor was not a perfect fix during this interim period until the new market comes into effect, but it did determine that some mitigation was due, and it gave the mitigation it felt would be helpful to keeping the price up, but not so high that it would, again, send an improper price signal. And below-cost capacity, Judge Brown, you were asking about that. It's a very specific definition. Below-cost capacity is capacity that comes into the market for any reason below its long-term average net cost, net of the funds that it gets out of the energy and ancillary services markets, and ISO New England as well. So it can be all different kinds of factual scenarios that cause someone to enter their capacity and try to enter their capacity into the market below cost, but all of those things are below cost capacity for purposes of this case. I'll turn to imports. I think Judge Santel was asking a question about that. With imports, the ISO New England had explained to the Commission, and it has been uncontested in this case in the record, that it's very difficult to tell whether an import is a new resource or not a new resource. And the offer floor, the new mitigation that will go in effect in the new system only mitigates new resources. So in order to make sure that, consistent with open access and non-discriminatory service, that only new resources would be mitigated, the commission adopted what was originally proposed in a little different context by the ISO New England, that an import would be considered new and therefore subject to mitigation only when a specific new external resource is identified as the sole support for the import and a significant investment, such as constructing a new transmission line, is made to provide capacity to New England. So it's what it's trying to do is treat to mitigate only new resources, whether they're internal to the New England market, to New England, or an import from outside.
The short-term rationale for that difference is that it's why they're attempting to mitigate only new.
Oh, that's a given. Only new resource. That's just how it's always been done. Only new resources are mitigated. So that's not even a question. And I'm sorry, perhaps my brief left that out as well. Didn't explain that sufficiently. That's always been true. Only new resources are mitigated. So no one's contesting the appropriateness of that.
So the distinction that council draws is not the right thing.
It's not the right distinction. The key is we want to make sure, the commission's making sure that, because it wants to make sure there's sufficient open access and non-discriminatory service. So they want to create a situation. Their proposal is that you can do it, you can mitigate those resources, whether they're new or existing resources, if they come in on a new transmission line. And the commission says, well, that's not appropriate. We don't do that for internal resources, so it's not fair to do that for external resources. They always have to be new. And the final thing I plan on addressing today, unless you have any other further questions, is regarding the why the commission adopted the internal market monitor, the external market monitor, and the ISO's proposal that the level at which D-list bids are reviewed by the internal market monitor goes down to $1 per kilowatt month. And what the petitioners never acknowledge or even address in their briefs is the reason that the commission did this. The commission made very clear, and this will get to your point, Judge Griffith, that modeling zones all the time, which everybody, the generators wanted as well, generators are challenging only the price level at which it is, not that all zones are being modeled all the time. And what that means is, before, the way the system used to work, you would only, in advance of the market, the internal market monitor, one of his many monitoring jobs in the ISO, he would look at the different zones, these eight zones that were set up, and determine in advance, do we think there's going to be enough capacity in that zone? If it turned out there wasn't enough capacity in that zone, then they couldn't change the price at that point. They would just reject D-list bids. And D-list bids are an existing supplier saying, I'll continue to supply at a certain price. So they would have to reject them. They would give that resource that higher D-list bid price and pay everybody else the market price. And it was for reliability purposes. Now, for reliability purposes, instead, they want to actually send appropriate locational signals. Sometimes there's congestion that shows up in the market after it's operating or after the auction's already open. Before, they can only reject D-list bids. Now, they're going to continue to model zones all the time. As a result, D-list bids will be able to set the clearing price, and that did not used to happen. Remember, they used to only get independently their own D-list price. Now, they can set the market D-list price, and so what happens is, and there's tremendous evidence in the record supporting this, that creates greater incentive and ability to use market power. And the internal market monitor said, you should use this $1 price from the reconfigurations auctions as a start. I recognize it's not a perfect proxy, but it is a capacity market. So capacity is bought and sold, and there's no price floor. The problem with the capacity market at issue here is there's a price floor, so we don't really know what the actual price is for capacity because it keeps stopping at the price floor. But that's not true in the reconfiguration market. People actually bought and sold capacity without a price floor, so that's a good basis to start. It'll be relooked at, and it is being relooked at. Now, whether the commission has made a post-record determination to minimize the number of zones that there will be. I don't know. The commission didn't base its determination on the fact there were going to be 8 zones. It based its determination on the fact that there were going to be modeling of zones all the time, whether there's 8, even 1. The point is that D-list bids can now set the clearing price, so there's an incentive for people to put in low bids and cause the market to separate, and so that they can then get their own bid price for every.
Thank you.
Unless there are any further questions? Thank you.
I have many, but...
Oh.
Maybe we don't know enough to ask.
Thank you so much.
Kimberly Frank for the State of Connecticut's Public Utilities Regulatory Authority. We're formerly the DPUC, the Connecticut Department of Public Utility Control. There's a name change. I'm addressing one issue, FERC's price floor remedy for the so-called historical out-of-market capacity. We've heard this morning petitioners painting this as potentially one of price manipulation. We've heard some loaded terms and phrases like states can make money or crater the market or bleed out the market and even my favorite, a death spiral. These are distractions for the real issue before the court. This matter is really a simple case of buyer's remorse about the alternative price rule that petitioners negotiated during the capacity market settlement. When the settlement was reached, most petitioners supported the alternative price rule as an integral part of the capacity market design. The rule did not mandate that out-of-market designated resources sell capacity at a certain price, nor did it bar them from selling capacity. Instead, the rule provided a market-wide price adjustment when collectively there was too much out-of-market new entry relative to the capacity need. The rule intended to and did preserve Connecticut's ability to ensure that reliable supplies of energy were available to serve the state's electric customers. The rule was crafted this way because at the time, Connecticut regulators were grappling with a significant capacity shortage in the state. The rule permitted Connecticut to take measures necessary to ensure that the state met in-state capacity requirements at levels set by the grid operator and approved by FERC. A prospective rule that generator petitioners seek will not change those past decisions, and petitioners who have benefited from the global settlement should not be permitted to reach back and change a core term of the deal with a new prospective rule. Petitioners insist that FERC's remedy extending the floor price is not reasonably calibrated to their estimated magnitude of harm, but they disregard this court's precedent and fail to come to grips with two fundamental facts. With respect to precedent, petitioners' assertion that FERC failed to properly calibrate the price floor remedy would have this court apply a far more stringent standard than required. Consistent with Judge Ginsburg's decision in Panhandle Eastern, FERC may set rates within a broad zone of reasonableness, taking into consideration broader policy considerations, as FERC counsel has described to you. With respect to the record facts, petitioners first failed to acknowledge that the floor price has provided compensation sufficient to cover their costs of supplying capacity. These are called going-forward costs, and their expert, Mr. Shanker, agrees that going-forward costs are the reasonable offer for existing resource. Second, petitioners refuse to confront the fact that even when new capacity is needed, the market price may not rise to a generator's cost of new entry. In New England, when supply is needed now, that gap can be met by cheaper resources like demand response and energy efficiency. Petitioners have also not demonstrated that their prospective mitigation rule is just and reasonable. The rule creates a phantom scarcity condition. It raises rates by arbitrarily barring resources that are currently selling capacity from making sales in future auctions. FERC properly recognized the market-wide harm this would cause and that this rule will not change those past decisions. In sum, FERC properly exercised its authority to fashion a remedy providing four additional years of minimum price assurance that provides petitioners with the opportunity to recover their costs of supplying capacity. And petitioners are not entitled to anything more from the Federal Power Act. Thank you. Do you have any questions? Thank you.
Before we begin rebuttal, Ms. Purcell, I'm sorry, I actually, I think one of the discussions by council had to do with the way in which what FERC is doing restricts the state's ability, to decide what kind of generation they want. Or I think, as I understood what he was saying, if states, for instance, want to do something that's more environmentally friendly and perhaps more costly. And I just wondered if you could respond to that.
I'm sorry, I got the wrong one.
Right, it can only duck so long.
Okay.
Well, I think as the commission explained in its orders, and particularly the third and fourth orders in this case, the states are free to do whatever they like with respect to their the resource decisions. If they want to subsidize certain types of resources rather than others, the minimum offer rule doesn't preclude them at all from doing so. Certainly to the extent they then want to take those resources and introduce them into the forward capacity market, that at that point the minimum offer rule would come into play. And as a petitioner's argument plays out, somehow that results in direct regulation of generation. But again, the states are free to do what they want. The commission's rules may make, incidentally, certain choices more economically palatable than others when viewed through the prism of the forward capacity market, but that's not a jurisdictional bar. That fact, as the court found in Connecticut, doesn't strip the commission of its authority to act.
All right. Thank you. Okay. Mr. Teichler, did he? Oh, okay.
Thank you very much.
2 minutes.
I should be able to. And that, I want to return to the off-bantied word out-of-market generation. The record simply does not support the characterization. It's a boogeyman. It's a made-up notion. There's not been no out-of-market generation sponsored by any state in New England since this settlement was approved. In fact, between the first capacity auction and the sixth, generation actually declined in the area. So we don't have this state-supported generation crashing the market. That is false. The only thing that has happened is there have been about 2,500 megawatts of capacity that's been added through demand resources and imported generation. That's it. That's all the record will support. When new entry is needed, there's nothing that's going to prevent the price from rising. A reason the price has fallen, and the commission has found it, it's in page 74 of the commission's brief, is there's very little, if any, cost of providing capacity from an existing resource. So under simple economic theory, the price in the short term will drop down to the factors of production for the next unit needed. Here, there are no factors of production. Here, capacity is a status. It is not a product. And that is the largest reason why the price has fallen so dramatically. And as soon as new capacity is needed, there's nothing in the existing rules that would prevent the price from rising.
Therefore,
there is no substantial evidence in support of the commission's action.
Which part of the commission's
action? Excuse me?
Any of the commission's action?
I still couldn't understand you.
Any of the commission's action, or what part of the commission's action?
Well, the wholesale revocation of the settlement and the creation of a new market of its own choosing, which counsel for the commission says isn't a market at all. You have a vertical demand curve. You have a flat supply curve. I mean, it just bears no resemblance to a free market operation.
Mr. Schwartz. 54 seconds. How much do you need?
Your Honor, I had requested 2 minutes.
2 minutes you got.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, counsel have talked about attempts to crash the market, but there is no FERC finding in this case. There's no FERC finding in the record that anyone has done that. If such situations do occur, FERC has ample authority under Section 222 of the Federal Power Act to address those situations individually. The possibility that somebody might attempt market manipulation doesn't justify adopting market-wide prophylactic rules that interfere with what nobody has contested is legitimate power supply planning decisions. My clients want to invest their own money in resources that offer them the characteristics they need: renewable resources, resources that balance out their fuel supply, resources that help them hedge their market risk. To the extent that there are any above market costs associated with those resources, my clients will bear them. They're not asking anybody else to bear those costs. FERC says that FERC attempts to cast its rule as only having an incidental effect on my clients' resource planning decisions, but that is the Commission attempting to have its cake and eat it too. FERC says with respect to new entry by merchant generators that the difference between what FERC characterizes as a suppressed price and a non-suppressed price is fatal to new merchant entry. But when it comes to our decisions to build new generation, FERC is willing to look at qualified capacity, say, sorry, it's going to cost you too much. We're going to ignore it. You're going to have to, if you want that resource, you're going to have to pay twice. And FERC is attempting to dismiss that as some minor and insubstantial infringement on our ability to make choices. Your Honor, FERC can't have it both ways. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Lampkin? Mr. Lampkin, you have 2 minutes.
This case is extraordinarily complicated, as the game of musical counsel reveals, but it really comes down to one thing: recovering the cost of new entry over time. And FERC does not dispute that there's a vanishingly small capability for generators to do that as a result of the changes it has made to the market. I want to start with, very briefly, historical below-cost entry. FERC's rationale for not adjusting in light of that right now is it would send the wrong market signals. We're not asking FERC to increase the price. We're just asking them to level the playing field. These are contracts for differences where people are continuously getting subsidies year in and year out. And all we're asking is that when we figure out who the most efficient generator is, it's done based on price that's not distorted by these subsidies. It's not a request that FERC actually monkey with price. It's leveling the playing field. And FERC does not pay enough attention to the long-term message, which is if somehow you get in under the radar, we're not going to adjust back to a just and reasonable price. We're going to leave the market artificially distressed, which tells every competitive supplier in the future that if they get in and something goes wrong, they will be a victim of below-cost pricing and they will not recover their costs. That means we're either going to have huge premiums for risk, or people aren't going to want to enter the market, and we're back to what Mr. Shepard called the bad old days of just subsidized generation. With respect to imports, Judge Sentel, my precise point is, yes, brand new entry, brand new facilities, 200 yards across the line, no mitigation whatsoever, so long as you use existing transmission facilities. That still doesn't make sense. FERC's rationale is it's just too hard to figure it out. Well, if they want to allocate the burden to make the person seeking mitigation have that burden, that's fine. But it's just too hard is not a reason to throw up your hands and leave clearly subsidized new entry from Canada or anywhere else across the line with no effort to mitigate. I see I'm out, but if I can take 1 minute to very quickly talk about the $1 price. Okay. And that is, through the $1 price, the only thing that the government says, look, we looked at an adjacent market, you know, it seemed reasonable, but No one's explained why we're using the lowest price from that market as the first place you can start responding to price. No one's explaining why we don't have any adjustments, and no one's explaining why, now that we actually have four zones, including a very large zone that's a combination of what were five, we haven't gone back to look at that again. In the end, this was just an arbitrary number, and when 10 cents a difference translates to tens of millions of dollars, it is not something that the court can affirm. Thank you very much.
Thank you.